Hello, and thanks for joining us. I'm Carol Jenkins, and the podcast is Black America on the Brink. We take a look at the issues facing Black America and what we need to do to make the best of it. It's an extension of our award-winning CUNY TV program, Black America. Our guest in a moment. It is our pleasure today to be talking with Kimberly Crenshaw, the mother of intersectionality, as we describe her. She'll talk a little bit about that later. Legal scholar at both Columbia and UCLA, directs the Intersectionality Center at Columbia, is also the head of the African American Policy Institute, and leads a very, very important campaign in this country called Say Her Name, which refers to the fact that in these last few years, when we have heard about man after man being shot by police or in some circumstance dying, the women are so seldom mentioned and never get the same amount of attention as the men. Kim, thanks so much for being with us today, and tell us a little bit more about Say Her Name.
Well, thanks for having me, Carol. Well, I think that your listeners probably would be able to understand the point if I just asked them to think for a moment. Do they recognize the name of Mike Brown or Freddie Gray or Eric Garner or Philando Castile? I think the vast majority of your listeners will recognize one, if not all, of those names. Then if I said, do you know the name Tanisha Anderson, Michelle Cassell, Kareen Gaines, India Beattie, India Kager, Maya Hall, but chances are they might not recognize any of those names and most likely would not know all of them. All of these are African-American people who have been killed by the police, but the only thing that distinguishes the names that people recognize from those that they don't is gender. So an entire movement and consciousness is being built, and rightly so, around police abuse of African Americans, but it is police abuse against African Americans of one gender. So Say Her Name is just quite frankly an effort to recognize that Black women also lose their lives to police violence, and they lose their lives in many of the same circumstances that men do. And many of the justifications that are given are equally specious as to why these Black people have lost their lives. But the difference is that the women's names are rarely recognized, held up, and are the centerpiece of mobilization against this issue. And if we can't see all aspects of how this plays out across gender in our community, then the movement against police violence is going to be partial. And so that's what Say Her Name is trying to do, make it an inclusive movement, understanding that women and girls are also killed by police.
And I have witnessed your work, and I one of the most chilling incidents that has occurred to me as an observer of your work was the film that you put together of the series of women that who have been assaulted or killed by police officers. I cannot tell you what I think of that. You know, from the student sitting in the chair, dragged around in the classroom by a security person, to Sandra Bland and everybody in between.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reality, Carol, is that these are images that are in plain sight. It's just that they've never been collected, partly because the framing of the problem doesn't include women. So when we started this campaign, we were marching in one of the marches that was called around the non-indictment of the killer of Eric Garner. And we went to the march, AAPF, with a poster of about 12 Black women who had been killed by the police. And it was remarkable how few people actually knew that Black women were killed by the police, and they didn't know their names. And some people just felt there was a dissonance that made them uncomfortable. Like, this is not supposed to be about women. Well, it is about women, too. So that prompted us to actually try to create a video that featured all of the black women that we knew about who had been killed by the police. Integrated into that was images of how black women are physically manhandled and pummeled and punched and stomped on by the police. So we integrate the images of this actually happening along with some of the women who did not survive their encounters with police. When you can't see something, you can't really solve it. So our hope was to bring into view the level of abuse that black women actually do experience at the hands of police.
Well, I think we could agree that the name of Corinne Gaines is one that will go down in the history books and be remembered. We have on the phone with us Rhonda Dormais, Corinne Gaines' mom. And you may remember the story of Corinne. One of the headlines that struck me from the Washington Post when this happened, it said, Corinne Gaines, cradling child and shotgun, is fatally shot by police. Rhonda, thanks so much for being on the phone. Her mom is with us.
Thank you for having me.
The news is, of course, that you have been granted, because of this police killing, a $37 million award, which is the first time that I can remember that anything that substantial and that plainly just was awarded. Talk to us a little bit about your daughter and the days that you're facing now with this award.
Well, you know, my baby, she would have been 26 this year, was murdered by Tactical Officer Royce Ruby on August 1st, 2016, while she was in her home with my grandson. Speaking to the news articles, I've seen so many different statements or, you know, releases that they've made, but no one could ever know what really went down unless they were in that courtroom. You know, we knew, but the world would not know, wouldn't even know if it hadn't gone this far. It would have been swept under the rug. But, you know, my lawyers, consisting of J. Wendell Gordon, Kenneth Rabinow, and Landon White, they collectively were able to get information and evidence, even out of depositions from these officers, that backed up the fact that she was unnecessarily murdered.
So these incidents that start from minor traffic encounters, it's just outrageous.
It is outrageous. And I mean, even with Sandra Bland, you know, she was ripped out of her car because basically she wouldn't put a cigarette out, you know, and ultimately her end was just crazy. I mean, how did this woman over a traffic stop being locked up because she wouldn't put her cigarette out, wound up dead? You know, there's so many mothers out here, fathers, family members of women who, again, are not acknowledged to the level that the men are. And I'm not saying that the men are any less important, of course not. But we have women, innocent women, who are just being gunned down, you know, like they're animals in the street without, you know, the officers have no impunity. They just, I don't know. And I'm just so overwhelmed, you know, right now. I really, really am. Even with this outcome, I'm still overwhelmed.
Sure, you've lost your child. The award was $37 million, $32 million to her son, your grandson Cody, who she was holding at the time and who was also shot.
Yeah. You know what? Cody deserves that and more, because after hearing the testimony of his psychiatrist, my grandson is messed up. Prayerfully, he can be treated, but he is not the same child that he was prior to August 1st of 2016. My grandson was full of life. You know, he was friendly, you know, talkative. Now he's more so withdrawn. He's become aggressive. You know, all of the hallmark characters that seem to come along with post-traumatic stress. You know, he's demonstrating all of them. You know, and like, what do you do? Money is not going to fix his memory. You know, money is not going to heal his heart from seeing his mother or his injuries. None of that is going to heal anything. So, you know, I don't know. The money is an excellent statement for law enforcement all over the world, you know, all over the United States, that this behavior is not acceptable. You have to be held accountable. You have to stand behind the beds that you swore to protect and serve the public, and it's not being done, and they're just getting away with it.
Yeah, well, I want you to know that just recently, a couple of nights ago, my daughter in her minivan, full of her children, with me sitting in the seat next to her, she was trying to park, and a guy pulled up beside her, rolled down his window, and started screaming at us for her trying to park, and was waving at what looked to be, or what he wanted us to believe was, a police badge. And my daughter and I actually thought that might have been our last moments on earth, you know, with the children sitting in the back seat of this car, you know, with a maniac who, police officer or not, was using that badge to try to, you know,
intimidate
us. Mm-hmm.
Why are they allowed to get away with this? That's what I need to know.
Well,
that's right.
Kimberly, talk to us about that in terms of the progress. This is progress, but there needs to be much more.
It does send a message, and I think our challenge now is to defend this judgment. Already, there are comments that, you know, try to dismiss the jurors. You know, they are disparaging the jurors, so. You know, this allows us to fight another day, and that is so important. And it becomes a benchmark against which to measure the impunity. As Rhonda mentioned, several of our mothers have cases that are going nowhere, in part because of this impunity. So, Tanisha Anderson, who was also killed a couple of years ago by police who the family had called to protect Tanisha. They ended up body slamming her and basically killing her with their hands. Those officers will not be facing any punishment whatsoever. India Kager, you mentioned a mom, you know, your daughter with kids in the back seat of the car. The police trailed her and her partner, the father of her child, while India's young child was in the back seat, and they ambushed them, pumped dozens of rounds into the car. She died trying to shield her child from the bullets. And so to date, nothing has happened there. And the thing that I think is so just bone-chilling about it is that children do not matter.
No.
It didn't matter, you know, that Karine was holding her child. It didn't matter that India had her child in the back. So it's a reflection of both the disregard for all life, including children, and these are not instances where one could say that the police officers had no choice. In both instances, the police officers were the aggressors. And what they were aggressing is against an idea that these people are not doing exactly what they're told, or they may constitute a threat, or they might be, you know, involved with someone else who could be potentially engaged in crime. So the lack of concern about these lives is manifest by looking at how little the risk to the officers were and how much that doesn't make any difference in the use of deadly force.
Right. So, and in our case, I want to make it clear that we have no way of knowing whether he was actually a police officer, but he was impersonating a police officer.
And that's something that came up in Corinne's trial, too.
Is that right? In what way?
Well, because when the two officers that initially responded to her home, when they went and got a key and found out that the chain was on the door, when they kicked the door open, they said on the stand, the one officer said that he didn't identify himself as an officer. So why do you think it's okay to, one, open somebody's door with a key, and then, two, kick it in, and then expect to be greeted like you're Santa Claus?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Kimberly, talk to us about Michelle Cousseau. Such an, when you talk about deadly force,
right?
You know, you always you always think, what about the old days when they used to shoot you in the knee? You know, I mean, what?
Yeah. So especially when you're in your own home, you know, and this is something that really needs to be reinforced. Corinne was shot in her own home. Michelle Cousseau shot in her own home. And in that instance, it was meant to be a welfare check. So she had missed a health appointment, a mental health appointment. There was some concern that she might be in some kind of a crisis. They dispatched police officers, which is, number one, always a bad idea. In mental health situations, police officers are not trained adequately to deal with mental health issues. You know, like they say, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you're a police officer, people aren't responding in the way you want them to respond. That becomes a resisting arrest or resisting, you know, the police officer. So when they arrived at the scene, Michelle didn't want to let them in. And she said, you know, I'm fine. Apparently, you know, a higher-ranking officer shows up, and he, I think, you know, the take charge, we're not having this kind of attitude. So, you know, basically, he says that she has a hammer in her hand. And that hammer, she says nothing, he testifies, but the look in her eye, he said, made him feel that he and his posse of officers were in danger. So he discharged his weapon and shot her through the heart.
Just
now, this
like
again,
that.
No crime has been committed.
Exactly. Exactly.
And this woman is dead.
So I want to ask you both, because we have now a case where there's justice. Not that, you know, Cody, you know, right now is having a good time. We pray that he will get better and recover. To you, Rhonda, and the rest of the family, there's a daughter as well. We have this award which speaks to the enormity of the crime that was committed, you know, which doesn't often happen. We also had on the streets, you know, thousands and thousands of people protesting. What works better? Is it the court? Is it the streets? Do you feel that the streets have led to this decision? Because there are some people who are saying that, you know, what happened to all of that protesting that was going on? It seemed to have evaporated.
Well, you know what? At the end of the day, you know, people want to get their message out, but people also have lives. It's nothing that people can take up every day, I mean, of the week. It's not possible. It's just not. You know, and it's a fact that when things are at the height of the moment, you get more out of people, and then when they die down, then, you know, things sort of go back to normal. But then you have to ask, normal for who? Normal for who? You know, while a lot of these supporters, and I love them, but a lot of them don't feel the pain that these mothers feel. And I definitely appreciate everything they've done, but we need to get within these court systems. We need to start voting and in who we want in and keeping out who we don't want in. And when they're not doing right, when they get in, then you have to make sure they don't get another term. I mean, I think that's probably a basis. I don't know, because I was forced into this, you know, the legal system with my daughter's case, you know, and following other people's cases. But it has to be clean from the inside out. You know, the system with law enforcement has to be clean from the inside out. People are not taking oaths to do what they're sworn to do. And that's just my opinion based on the facts of my life.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. I mean, we have a crisis of accountability. We have a pattern and a practice of reinforcing police officers' choices under this broad frame that effectively removes them from any meaningful constraint on what they do. When we're not involved in the court system, when we're not you know, vigilant about pursuing these cases when we're not on juries. This is what systemic oppression looks like. Well, we need to have more opportunities and capacity to actually break some of the systemic ways in which this problem reproduces itself. And frankly, when it comes to what has happened to the movement, let us not forget that we are now in a period where the chief law enforcement at the national level officer and organization has identified leaders of this movement as themselves criminal problems, mm-hmm. as themselves, identity extremists. We're looking at a situation that may not be unlike the way Martin Luther King, SCLC, the Panthers, SNCC, all of the organizations during the 60s were themselves seen as more of the problem than the problem that they were protesting against. So the condition is not one that is always amenable to growing influence on the part of ordinary people, you know, like you and me. That's as much of a part of this problem as the actual officers' actions.
Right. So the title of this podcast series is Black America on the Brink. Where do you each feel Black America is? Is it on the brink of good things, disaster? Where do you see us, Kim?
Well, I think we're on the brink of repeating what happened at the end of the first Reconstruction. I mean, frankly, you know, it's not known, but the truth of the matter is that African Americans were politically active. We were senators. We had political clout. We were able to do any number of things that, helped remake this country after the end of slavery, and it got wiped out by a terrible, presidency, by the Supreme Court abandoning us, by the media deciding that this issue was over, by political parties believing that they would benefit not one whit by continuing the quest for justice. And when I look around today, I see too many things that remind me of that era. A presidency that's a disaster for us, a Supreme Court that has unleashed the police, a Supreme Court that has gutted the Voting Rights Act, a mainstream media that seems to be more interested in the angry white voters that put this Trump into the White House rather than the ongoing issues that all working people and people of color and women face. So this is a moment where I think if we don't stand up and fight like our lives depend on it, because they do, we will see more lost lives happen with impunity.
Rhonda?
You know what? these last 4 years, and I'm gonna say it goes way back before Freddie Gray, but for me in my community, Freddie Gray also kicked off people's acknowledgement of the corruptness of the system, you know, people that live amongst it. And it's almost like when they start to speak out, they're ostracized, you know. So as far as things going back, they very much look like they're going back to the way things used to be in my grandmother's era and my great-grandmother's era, you know. And like Dr. Kim said, we're going to fight. We have to fight. I mean, even with this decision for my daughter, I have to continue to fight. I have to continue to be her voice for her, for other mothers who didn't receive the justice that they look to receive. I still have to fight for them. Is it a struggle? Yes, because that verdict didn't do anything for my heart. My heart is still broken. I'm happy because it set a precedent. It's letting the law enforcement of Baltimore County know that this behavior is not tolerable, and it won't be tolerated. You know, so, I mean, it's just, like I said, it's just overwhelming. And I thank you, Dr. Crenshaw, for allowing me and giving me the courage, because AAPF was the first organization that looked to me to allow me to speak, to allow to be my daughter's voice, to allow all the other mothers who've lost daughters to have a voice. You know, it's just amazing what the organization does and has done and will continue to do. You know, so I just want to, you know, send that thank you to you, Dr. Kim. And Carol, thank you so much for having me.
And Rhonda Dormais, thank you so much. And thank you for your, for being your daughter's voice. She's got an eloquent spokeswoman.
Thank you
for joining us today. Kim Crenshaw, thank you for your years and years of work making us pay attention to the things that we need to pay attention to.
Thank you both.
Thanks for being with us for Black America on the Brink. Watch our award-winning television show, Black America, on CUNY TV. And thanks to our crew, executive in charge, Susan Iger, producers, Audra West and Christy St. John, engineers, Jack Horowitz and Sarah Fishman. Our music theme is by Tyreek Keys Washington. And we come to you from the radio studios of City University of New York. Let's talk again soon.